The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to day 15 of the Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar. It's a frosty morning, the pond is frozen, and we're getting ever so close to Christmas. And I know some of you have been binging on this, particularly at the weekends. So it seems you're a bit like me, and you like to listen to podcasts whilst doing your Christmas shopping to keep you a little bit zen among the chaos. So when we started this, I didn't know whether we were going to be able to do an episode every day, but we seem to have rather a lot of interviews stacking up. So it's a packed one today. I've put a few in together. Let's open the door.
We're backstage here at Cheltenham Science Festival's Lab Live.
Hi, I'm Lizzie Goodger, and I am the Schools and Family Programme Manager for the Cheltenham Science Festival. And I'm a big fan of pterosaurs and all things dinosaur.
Well, so your background's in paleontology?
Yes, and geology.
What is your favourite science fiction?
Discworld. Terry Pratchett's Discworld. I've got every single book. I've read all of them at least 2, 3, maybe 4 times. It's just incredible. The science behind it is phenomenal. He's just the best man.
Good call. What are you most looking forward to seeing in 2019?
Well, as a paleontologist and a fan of things which are on ice, I would really love to see Jurassic Park on ice.
I'm Dr. Jessica Barker, aka Jess, and I am one of the co-founders and co-CEOs of Sygenta, a cybersecurity company.
My name is FC, aka Freaky Clown. I'm an ethical hacker, also co-founder and co-CEO of Sygenta.
Hacking. What I know about it is we've got bots and trolls attacking us from Russia and influencing elections. Do you guys get involved with that kind?
We've been involved in all sorts of things, to be honest. Working with government and private corporations. We do a lot of outreach, a lot of work with the public as well. Our main sort of day-to-day work is with big companies, usually financial services, who face all sorts of threats, from nation state through to organised criminal gangs who are really active in cybercrime now, through to the kind of so-called script kiddie teenager in a bedroom, doesn't know what they're doing, but actually is able to download some stuff and carry out malicious cyber activity, through to actually people in the company who are just trying to do their jobs but make a mistake, leak information, click on links they shouldn't, that kind of thing as well.
So companies basically come to us and say, we want you to break into our systems, into our like corporate networks, into our buildings, you know, physically as well as digitally, and tell us how you got in so that we can rectify it so that criminals can't use those methods to get in.
Are there any kind of high profile ones that you've been involved with? I understand there was quite a bad one with was it Maersk Shipping Company? That was like one of the worst ones that's happened.
But yeah, there's been in the last couple of years some huge cyber attacks. Maersk's a really good example. They got caught up in a cyber attack known as NotPetya, a big ransomware, cost them hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars. So it's a huge thing affecting loads of companies. One thing that's really interesting over the last couple of years is how much more we're hearing about these attacks. Both at the company level, but also at the government level as well. We've seen the UK and the US, for example, talking about nation state hacking in a way that they weren't doing even 5 years ago.
How do you get into this kind of line of work? Do you just start being a naughty hacker and then people are like, you're a naughty hacker, but thank you because you're an ethical hacker, and then you're like, guys, I hacked you, this isn't very good.
No, that's the complete opposite bad way of, you'll never get in if you're doing bad stuff, because it requires a lot of trust and a lot of clearances to get to the sort of level that we're at. So for me, I grew up with computers when I was a little kid. And yeah, I remember the World Wide Web being invented and sort of seeing the first links. So I've been there since the start, and just messing around with computers back then was how you used a computer. You didn't get anything with the computer, you had to write it all yourself. So getting in to understanding how computers worked was vital, otherwise you'd never get anywhere. It's a lot easier now to get into this field, for kids nowadays, which is what we're trying to encourage. But that's how I got into it. I just grew up with it, and thankfully, somehow it turned into an industry that I could get a career in.
Right. So when you say you're trying to encourage kids to get into this, are you encouraging kids to become hackers or just to get into kind of IT in general?
Both, actually.
I mean, on one end of the spectrum, we're just encouraging kids and adults and everyone really to be safer online. So that's part of our outreach. But also we're really keen on raising awareness of this as an industry and a legitimate profession, not just among the kids and the teenagers, but also their parents and their teachers, because many people don't realise you can be a legitimate hacker. Usually the word hacker is used synonymously as criminal. And actually, there are loads of ethical hackers working in our country and abroad, making good money, having lots of fun, and doing it in a legitimate, legal, ethical way. So we're keen to raise awareness.
I understand that the FC Freaky Clown thing is part of kind of maintaining your anonymity, is that correct?
Yes.
And so how important is that within this line of work? And so, and why don't you have a cool nickname?
I mean I do, but I only share that with my friends.
because of my past and some of the people that we've gone up against as part of that work, it makes it just a little bit safer for my friends and family if I go under an alias.
Okay, that's fair enough.
And I've just always been known by my name. I mean, you have people in this industry who have kind of aliases and try a bit harder to keep their anonymity. I've just not been one of those people. It's really hard now in this internet age, I think, to have anonymity.
You can't get famous being called Bob.
So when I think kind of science fiction, I look back to, like, you know, Angelina Jolie in Hackers and, you know, The Matrix, which now came out in 99, which makes me feel really old.
Yeah.
But films like this, do they register on, you know, high up there as hacker kind of sci-fi super films? Or
they're not particularly accurate, let's put it that way.
They're quite popular in the industry as a way of kind of just laughing, you know, a love to hate with a lot of these kind of things. The Matrix is popular.
Matrix
is definitely popular. Hackers, Swordfish.
Yes.
Sneakers.
Yeah.
There's the TV series Scorpion.
Oh, yeah,
which
is
if you've not
hilarious.
Seen, it's a treat. This is the most wrong ever. So that's a good one to
And Mr. Robot, obviously.
Mr. Robot's good, actually. A pretty good representation of hackers.
Is Hackers a little bit like The Room for hackers? It's like, it's so bad, it's good kind of film? Or?
Yeah. It's a cult movie, definitely, within this industry.
Okay, so do you have a favourite sci-fi?
All of them, I think. I'm a massive fan of, like, the really old school B movies. You know, so It Came from the Desert, stuff like that.
And I'm trying to think about sci-fi. We were talking about this before, and I was saying Chappie. I really like Chappie. Always makes me cry, though.
Yeah.
I struggle to talk about Chappie.
Even talking about Chappie
without crying. And that's probably controversial as a favourite sci-fi movie, but.
I mean, I enjoyed it, but I was sat there thinking, this is essentially District 9 meets Short Circuit.
Yes,
exactly. But anything wrong with that? District 9, also great film.
Well, can I ruin Short Circuit 2 for you slightly?
Mm.
You know Ben Javeri?
Yeah.
He is an Indian in real life. He was browned up for the film.
Oh,
and it links him with Hackers, because the actor is the baddie in Hackers.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh dear.
There you go. Sorry, I've just ruined Ben Javeri for
what
you.
What a way to start a Monday.
There we go.
Recently we were on the set of Back to the Future, which was really cool.
And
we're in Universal in LA, and we got to walk out onto the square and go up to the clock tower and stuff. It was really cool to see that. Yeah.
Was it great, Scott?
I'm sorry.
Can we go back in time?
Yeah.
So my name is Elspeth Kenny. I am the Education Manager for Science with Cheltenham Festivals. So my PhD was on animal behaviour, at its most general. If you get a bit more specific, it was about bird behaviour. Specific again, it was bird social behaviour. Specifically again, it was on birds when they preen each other, and it was about sort of pair bonding and how birds are friends, essentially. And I did my field work on a tiny island just off Wales called Skomer Island, which is absolutely beautiful. Cheltenham Festivals runs a science communication competition for researchers called FameLab. And I did that about 5 years ago now, and I was the UK runner-up, which is very exciting. I did a talk about the blue-footed booby, which is an amazing bird with bright blue feet, and I talked about siblicide, so when siblings try and kill each other. But yeah, I'm a keen advocate of women in STEM, and trying to encourage and support women in all sorts of STEM industries. And I'd really like to get a female scientist on a banknote.
This is the £50 banknote, which people are voting for. So which scientist did you vote for?
Ada Lovelace would be... I feel like she's the most famous, so we could start with her and then get as many more as possible.
My name's Matthew Tosh, and I am a science presenter, but I'm also a pyrotechnician.
How were you able to turn this into a full-time job? Like, this is amazing.
When I was young, I was very curious, not just about fire, but how stuff works in general. And that sort of followed through to me taking up physics at university, trying to understand how materials behave, why things behave in the way that they do. But the interest in fireworks, I've always had this fascination about technical things behind the scenes. I mean, today we're in a theatre. I've always been drawn to that, the behind-the-scenes workings that go on. So you go to a theatre show, there's things moving backstage that you don't normally see, but it's making the show work. And so the same thing happens in a firework display. And when I was little, I used to enjoy going to the firework displays with my parents and turning up early. I was an absolute nightmare. I drove my parents potty because I'd want to get there early before everyone arrived and see the crews finishing with the setup that was going on. And you could see things sort of out on the field, sort of set up, and you think, well, there's something pointing off to the left there, so perhaps something's going to fire to the left. And I was delighted when I'd see something fire to the left, or something would start spinning around. So that kind of got my that fueled the curiosity. But it wasn't until many, many years later, when I was actually a science teacher, and I needed to teach about health and safety as one of my applied science groups. And I had somebody come into school to do the equivalent of a STEM ambassador talk. It was just before the STEM ambassadors program kicked off. And he was from a firework company talking about how they approach safety in firework displays. Okay. And that was the beginning of that relationship. And it was a slippery slope since then. I've not looked back.
So that's interesting because, you know, generally people regard health and safety as kind of the boring part of it. And I'm impressed that you're able to, I guess, use health and safety in an interesting way and still get away with doing, you know, one of the more explosive shows that is happening on the science circuit.
Well, you said get away, but it's not getting away, it's actually making it happen. And that, this is what's been so transformational about getting involved in fireworks, because when I was a science teacher, we were forever, you probably relate to this, I was forever being told, oh, we can't do that because of health and safety, not allowed to do this because of health and safety. And it was moan, 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 continue all the time. You felt really constrained by it. But what I found with the fireworks industry is, more often than not, you inherit a contract to make a show happen at a particular place. So it could be in a field. You've got a contract to deliver a show on the 5th of November in a field. One of the ones I get involved in not far from here is Cheltenham Racecourse. You know, so we've got the racecourse. How do we make that show happen safely? Right. If you're doing it on a bridge, what do we need to do? What's going under the bridge? Is it a river? If so, we need to close the river, make sure there's no boats going through there. And so the conversation goes from being what's not allowed to, well, what do we need to put in place to make it happen? And that's, you know, that's, those conversations are happening all the time in the fireworks industry. Well, of course, for me as a science teacher at the time and a sort of fledgling science presenter, that was revolutionary. So suddenly, we're now thinking, well, okay, I want to do these kinds of shows. So what do I need to put in place in order to make them happen and to make them happen safely? And so the conversations are all around solutions. They've become much more solutions focused.
It sounds like a much more positive slant to have on things.
Oh, yeah. It is. And this has actually started some great conversations with colleagues who are on the SciComm circuit, other presenters. So people I've worked with behind the scenes at festivals have approached me,
privately and directly, and said, you know, we've worked together and we've cobbled together the risk assessments or taken what they were already doing and sort of repackaged it and make their approach much more enabling and working with the venues that they want to go and visit and the festivals that they want to go and visit as well.
Oh, fantastic. So having kind of gone through and doing this, these kind of safe explosions, is there been an instance where it's been particularly challenging or something that that you've seen someone else do that you're like, oh, I can't believe they're doing that, or something that you've seen someone else do and I can't believe they're doing that, but they're actually doing it in a really safe manner, or, you know, or...
It's really eye-opening. I mean, it's like any industry that you go in, you see other people doing things and you think, ooh, it's a little bit close to the knuckle. And that, to be fair, is actually why some organisations will bring me in to advise and help steer them in the right direction, because they've identified a possible exposure, what we call an exposure risk, a weakness, or something that they're a little bit unconcerned about. Often it's solved with a conversation, you know. Right. But if there's a bit more involved, then obviously there's a bit more work there, and it may involve me reviewing risk assessments on behalf of somebody, or having a conversation of how are you setting your show up. So I'm seeing all sorts of things all the time, and it can be a fairly straightforward show, but a presenter's not thought about, you know, just the layout of their props, and suddenly they've got children on stage or volunteers on stage and their elbows and things are knocking things and it's just cluttered. And that's quite a straightforward one to resolve. It's looking at the blocking, the stage management. Other ones are a bit more challenging because people want to use gases, various different reagents that all in one location are not terribly compatible, you know. And then you've got to think, well, okay, if we need to make this happen, I need separate areas of the building, each with people keeping those areas secure so people can go and tamper with things backstage. And it starts getting very, very geeky.
Yes.
Very fascinating. I think one of the most challenging ones I've had recently, I was working with Greg Foote and William Stockburn from the University of Central Lancashire, and we took 12 demos related to the it was a take on the 12 Days of Christmas. And we took this to the Hammersmith Apollo as part of Brian Cox's and Robin Ince's Christmas Compendium of Reason.
Yeah.
So Greg had got a little slot on there, and he said, right, I want to do 12 demos in 12 minutes.
Wow.
And we got things relating to fire, we were doing explosions, we got cryogenics, we got alcohol, flammable fuels on stage, we wanted volunteers involved, and pyrotechnics as well. So there's all this stuff that was in this kind of melting pot, and the challenge was to make it happen at quite short notice as well, bearing in mind all the other constraints. You've got other people on stage, you've got projector screens, you've got the audience not too far away, and with 3,500 people watching, there's not a lot of wriggle room for getting it wrong.
I imagine, yeah. So everything went according to plan?
Pretty much. I mean, it wasn't done... We were trying to do it in 12 minutes. That wasn't quite going to happen because of a lot of... we were quite restricted backstage by how much space we'd got to use, because there were bands setting up and people were coming and going, because we were sort of in the second half of the show. So there's a lot of stage management and prop management behind the scenes you've got to think of. And you're working in the dark, so you've got head torches on, you know, trying to work... get it all sorted. But it was it really tested us, and we had a whale of a time.
Oh, that sounds amazing. So this wouldn't be Cosmic Shed if we didn't talk a little bit about science fiction, and I imagine as an explosions expert that you particularly hate sci-fi. Where there's an explosion in outer space and you shouldn't be able to hear it because it's the vacuum. So, but do you have a favourite sci-fi?
Oh gosh, say favourite sci-fi. I'm more actually into sort of the characters. So it'd be things. I mean, I was a huge fan of things like Superman when I was little. So those sort of heroes and people with superpowers. The other one I did watch as a child was Star Trek, and it was the original Star Trek in you know, black and white. My mum was a huge fan, so she kind of indoctrinated us in that. And I've sort of, as I've got older, and I think because I've noticed how cheesy the science is in it, it's really annoyed me, and I've kind of tailed it away from them. And I'm going to make a confession here. You know, it's Christmas. I believe that one should be very honest with listeners. Now, please don't judge me, but I've never seen Star Wars.
Whoa. Dr. Suze Kundu.
Hi, Russell. I'm a nanochemist by trade, and I'm also head of public engagement at a technology company called Digital Science. I quite like a lot of sci-fi because I love the fact that it's such a driving force for real science to happen. So you get a lot of that in the old Star Trek, but I have to say my favourite is probably around the superhero universe, particularly enjoying all the antics of the Avengers at the moment.
Amazing, and obviously that's what your talk kind of focused on, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was looking at the current research that's making a lot of these individual superpowers more of a reality, but particularly focusing on the fact that possibly the best equipped superheroes are the engineers, so it's the Batmans and the Ironmans of the world that seem to be doing rather well at having all of the superpowers rather than just a couple that they got accidentally. I have hopes for 2019 that I think are analogous to material science. I think the best material science happens through collaboration. My hopes for 2019 are that nothing impedes that collaboration, that we still manage to continue to work with people across the world on lots of amazing projects. So I think I would like more of the same. And I think sometimes I worry that politics may not lend itself well to that, but I'm hopeful that the needs of the many will outweigh the needs of the few.
Thank you so much to everyone for talking to us there. And I can only feel for Matthew Tosh. I suppose we can help with that. And Matthew, if you search for the Machete Order and the Phantom Edit, then you should be okay. And we'll see you tomorrow for day 16 of the Cosmic Shed Advent Calendar.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.